Welcome everyone to the Friday night public discussion group of Perfecting Horizons Institute. We are in paper 59, section 5, which is old single column, page 680. All right, we're ready to move into the Carboniferous period. And recall, we're stepping through the periods here of the marine life era. We have a couple more to go. And things are definitely building to much more intriguing stages now. There's lots of foreshadowing beginning to happen. That's the thing about facts. You can lay out lots and lots of facts in front of you. You can even lay out lots and lots of facts spanning lots and lots of time. But it always takes a very, very extensive span of facts and time to begin to recognize the truth that's flowing through those facts. So that's what I'm hinting at. We're very much going to start to see all the more so the truth that's flowing through the facts, what I've been hinting at ever since we started here with the historical geology, that this whole evolutionary process is the evolution of humans. And there really is only one thing evolving on an inhabited world. And, it's not in fact an inhabited world until, way down the road. But in truth, it's an inhabited world, as far back as you can go. You can go back a trillion years, long before there was even our sun and the galaxy that it formed in and all that. I mean, because they're the truths of eternity, right? The truth is not in those facts. Right, it's imposed from eternity on the facts. It transcends even a trillion years of facts. In truth, there's always been this inhabited world. Yeah, temporally, no. In fact, it hasn't always been here. But in truth, yes. And so you're in striving for the truth. You're striving for that recognition. Now, before we get right into this section proper...
Before you go on, yeah. That statement you just made.
Okay.
That's a little hard for me to understand, then. What's the difference between reality and truth, then? Because, as we live here as evolutionary mortals being born here, etc., and as everybody else is living out in their universes on planets, the facts are that they are. There is reality to that. I mean, it's set up that way. It's not just a dream. It's
right.
Really happening. So how do you distinguish between, as you say, the truth, but there's also some truth in the facts that...
So
maybe I got confused there a little
right,
bit.
Right. So the important thing to recognize is the word reality is the most general word. It's the overarching word. You can speak about the facts of reality or the truths of reality, or you can even speak about the goodness of reality.
But you don't discount any of them, really, right?
They're all part of reality. Okay. Right? The truth is part of reality. Fact is part of the reality. But to discriminate truth from fact... remember, you have no experience with that. I mean, no one has ever educated you in this regard. No human, no institution understands this. Right? I mean, the fifth epical revelation is here to finally challenge us to begin to recognize that. What to use the word truth for? It's not what we've always used it for. It isn't really what we've always used that word for. And we've used it for that which isn't really truth. We've used it for fact, basically, aspects of factness. like true and false tests, right? That isn't a true and false test. That's a correct and incorrect test, or a fact or non-fact test. I mean, you know, that's what you're actually testing there. The initial challenge is not to try to figure out what truth is, but to try to recognize what it isn't. Right? To just start going through the list. And you get to truth initially by exhaustive elimination of everything that it isn't, just like you get to personality by exhaustive elimination of everything that it isn't, right? It isn't anything that humans have ever thought, personality. You know, and the same with truth, right? But I can give you hints. I can give you hints like, you can obey truth, but you can't obey facts. Or I can give you hints like, you use the word facts when you're talking about parts most immediately. But the essence of truth is wholeness. You're trying to get at the essence of the whole, the truth of it, in contrast to the specifics of the parts, the facts of them. Okay, just hold that abstraction in your mind and slowly try to appreciate. You know, and the other contrast I just used a second ago, the facts of time, the truths of eternity. Right? So, you know, if you're looking at something, you go, well, is this a fact or is this a truth? Well, ask yourself a simple question. Is it temporal? Then it's, you know, if it's temporal, it's not truth.
Doesn't mean it doesn't have value,
but again, it's just, we can't be afraid to separate truth. You know, it's like we aren't going to, remember, I mean, truth encompasses everything. So, you know, there's going to be things, meanings, and values all within that wholeness of truth. You're not going to lose any of the things or the meanings or the values of a situation. You're going to try to separate that. What's the thing of the situation? What's the value in this situation? What's the consequent meaning in this situation? What's the truth that encompasses the whole situation? It's like, wow, that's really complicated.
Truth is always, it's not static, right? I mean, it's always...
Right, and then you, you know, and then, and right now you get that whole other issue that, you know, that when you're talking about experiential truth, you're talking about truth that engages fact. And it's like, well, how does that work? How do the truths of eternity engage the facts of time? I mean, isn't there this, you know, extreme screeching sound as as those are wrenching past each other?
These are things we learn as we grow.
You know, so, but you want to, you want to start with, just before you try to figure out how to bring fact and truth together, just try to think about them separately. You know, that, you know, that you're, there's an essence to what you're contemplating that is not down in the weeds. It's not, and it's not a function of space and time. And it's not visible. And it's nothing that I can tell you about. You know, the things I can tell you about, that's knowledge. You know, but truth is something you can experience, even though you can't communicate that experience to anyone in any direct way. You can attempt to communicate facts that are related to that truth, and hope that that other person can reflect on those facts and follow them back up to the wholeness of truth that you discovered, right? I'm holding a 2,000-page book in my lap where Revelators did that. They flattened the wholeness of truth onto pages, right? And technically killed it, right?
That's why they said Jesus was the truth for
right?
generation?
Right? Now, I mean, he has truth in his mind. Right, he embodied the truth, and he encouraged others to follow him up to that recognition of truth and that synchronization with ever greater truth, ever greater wholeness. Right? Now, it's It's a lost art, right? I mean, humans are really fixated on facts, and they think that they can jot down all the facts, they have the truth of the situation. You know, no, you don't, right? And there's a million ways to erroneously contemplate those facts, and only one true way, right? You know, and that, you know, that's what you're looking for. And you see, there's no way that you can hope to find that true way of encompassing those facts if you haven't separated truth from fact, you know, at least abstractly to begin with, right? Yeah, you know, there's this essence of the wholeness of something that's either there or it isn't, you know, and you can develop the skill to discriminate between negative wholeness, error, and positive wholeness, truth. I mean, people, you know, we all instinctually desire, even if we don't try to, you know, give it sort of scholarly expression like I'm trying to do right now, I mean, we all try to find a worldview that has an apparent wholeness to it. We just don't recognize, and revelators are trying to help us with that, that just because there's wholeness doesn't mean there's truth. There's a fake, a deceptive wholeness called falsehood that something can have. It can be just as delightfully holistic, but it's falsehood, not truth. So, and subjectively, you can't discriminate between truth and falsehood. They feel the same. You know, you finally develop the skill to feel the wholeness of something. But if you don't have an objective skill, if you just have a subjective skill, you'll go, yep, it's whole, therefore it's truth. No, it's error. That kind of wholeness is falsehood. It's like, well, how do you tell the difference? Yeah, therein lies the very challenging problem. How do you tell the difference? It's not apparent. Now, the good news is if you develop your relationship with the three cosmic intuitions enough, that allows a fourth intuition, a fourth cosmic intuition to come into play, the spirit of truth, which actually is a direct insight that can discriminate between truth and falsehood. You know, like the first can discriminate between fact and figment. Right? But that's a very advanced frame of mind where you even can begin to use the spirit of truth as that insight into positive or negative wholeness. Okay, so not to belabor it anymore, but that, you know, that's. But it doesn't hurt to keep coming back to this, because again, remember, that's the whole point of what we're trying to do here. The whole point of reading about the Carboniferous here is not the immediate facts of the Carboniferous. I can't obey the facts of the Carboniferous or any other facts. That's who cares, right? But if I can find the truth of the Carboniferous, those are the truths of eternity. Those truths apply everywhere for all time. Right? And they'll completely transform my life if I can find them. Truths of marriage and family, same way. The truths of government, you know, the truths of atomic structure, whatever it is, right? Those truths apply everywhere for all time, not just to atoms, not just to marriages, not just to. So, because, and this distinction is vital. For in a cosmic system, the individual members are not connected with each other except in relation to the whole and through the individuality of the whole. Right? If you don't want to live an ever more lonely island universe existence, you have to find the truth of the whole, because it's only in that discovery that you can really be connected to anyone else. And that's the fifth epical revelation. Okay, to the Carboniferous. Okay, so before we get into section 5 proper, we need to recognize that we actually had entered the Carboniferous at the end of the previous section. You may recall, if you flip back to the end of section 3, that the Silurian was 25 million years. Right, we had a 5 there. See, so, you know, we've got boundaries that are in between these every 10 million years things that we're stepping. So, you know, roughly in the middle of, from 230 million years ago, the end of the previous section, to 220 million years ago, you can see where we start this section, we've moved into the Carboniferous. Right? And you can see that. Now, that's why I'm going to go back and read it, that next to the last paragraph in section 4, just to recognize now that they're really speaking of the beginning of the Carboniferous there, when they say, the elevation of the continents proceeded and the atmosphere was becoming enriched with oxygen. The earth was overspread with vast forests of ferns 100 feet high. And by the peculiar trees of those days, silent forests, not a sound was heard, not even the rustle of a leaf, for such trees had no leaves. Okay. 100-foot ferns, okay, we're in the Carboniferous. Okay. And you can see they've got half of the picture there, and they'll give you the other half in a second, with the atmosphere. Right. Now that we very definitively have vegetation aggressively alive on the planet, the carbon dioxide is going to come down significantly finally, you know, in the Carboniferous. And the oxygen is going to definitely push up. Okay? So, the oxygen has been a little bit, on the low side, and the carbon dioxide has been a little bit on the high side for a long time here now. That's finally going to start to move, because we've got a lot of plant life, and that carbon is going, and that carbon dioxide is going to be taken out of the air, and sequestered into the ground, and that's why they call this age the Carboniferous, right? Because those layers of the earth are carbon-bearing, Carboniferous. Right? They bear the carbon that used to be in the atmosphere.
The trees do that, or the vegetation?
All the vegetation is pulling the carbon dioxide out and, putting oxygen back up. Using the carbon to build them, their plant form. Right, all the organic molecules, and putting oxygen into the air, getting things prepped for animals, that need more oxygen, especially more advanced animals.
When they decay, when they die, the carbon that makes them up is now just...
Right, and that's what we're about to read about. I mean, all that carbon is within them and can very easily get locked into beds of... oil and gas and coal, right? The thing I want to do just right up front, before we get into it, is about this truth issue. The entire Carboniferous period, especially in North America, is often broken up into two periods instead of just one period. An early period called the Mississippian, and a later period called the Pennsylvanian. Okay. And so as you're reading this, you notice, did they just decide to kind of go more with the European than the American geologists there and used Carboniferous? Because obviously, calling it Mississippi and Pennsylvania, that's coming from the American geologists, right? Not the Brits, okay? And no, right? Because again, remember, the whole point is to reveal truth. And like I've been hinting, we're very much starting to see truth manifest. The truth about this time is that the carbon is being sequestered. Because this is part of humanity that we're studying here. There's no way to get advanced civilization eventually on an inhabited world without carbon getting sequestered that can be brought back up and used. You know? Right? I mean, if you hadn't had coal, how could you have done the Industrial Revolution? Right? How would that have happened? Right? Yep.
Well, England was largely covered by forests at one time. In the beginning of the Industrial Revolution, most of the trees were cut down to make charcoal.
Yeah.
And then when the trees started, were practically depleted, that's when they discovered that they could use coal instead. But initially, they were just going gung-ho with
right.
making charcoal.
Necessity is the mother of invention. And right, and so right, the evolutionary process and the difficulties pushed them finally to make this great discovery. Coincidentally, long ago, right, the god of evolution saved up some fuel for you. Right? I mean, long before animals needed shells to protect them from predators, they had shells. Long before humans needed right, carbon-based fuels, they were stored up for us. Right? I mean, that's the truth of it.
Right?
The truth is it's a carboniferous. You know, and if you want to focus in on some facts, you can separate it into the Mississippian and the Pennsylvanian, and you know, then that's all fine and dandy. But overarching is a great truth, right? There's no way that any world would ever get to light and life if at some point in the distant past there wasn't fuel sequestered for their future use. Right? You know, and coincidentally, an evolutionary process pushes them to make this discovery. Well, I'll be danged, this is handy.
There's something beyond that.
I wonder who stored this up for us. Right?
Don't they say that?
You know, and of course, everything is a means to a greater end, right? I mean, the fact of coal is not the truth of coal, right? The fact of coal is not part of eternity. The truth of coal is part of eternity. The truth that this is a world where there's an evolutionary process, right? And coal is and oil and you know natural gas are indispensable to the progress of civilization on every world. You know, unless it's a world where you have very artificial help, like a non-breather world or something like that. Okay, that's a different story. But a very down in the trenches evolutionary world like ours, you know, very much so. Okay. And you'll see as we get into here, they throw a delightful little zinger into the middle of the section, speaking to this very issue. Okay, so let's get into it here.
5, the crustal shifting stage, the fern forest carboniferous period, the age of frogs. The appearance of fish during the preceding period marks the apex of marine life evolution. From this point onward, the evolution of land life becomes increasingly important, and this period opens with the stage almost ideally set for the appearance of the first land animals.
Okay, so just a basic thing that's setting you up there, right? I mean, there is a handing off that's part of the truth that's flowing through this. You are inexorably moving from pre-humans are in the ocean to pre-humans are on the land. Right? That transition is afoot here. Pardon the pun, literally. I mean, we have little feet running around on the land here shortly. Okay, but they quickly are big feet. Right? They go from little feet to big feet in very short order. But see, that's what they're getting at. See, it marks the apex of marine life evolution, right? It reaches a peak, and that's it. And we saw it very definitively with the fish, you know, in the Devonian, in the previous period. Suddenly there were fishes, you know, they reach a plateau, and then they just have stayed that way unchanged ever since, right? Because you max that out, right? And you move to the next phase. Just like we were talking about, you know, You use coal to get to the, you know, and oil and natural gas to get to the next phase. But you use it. You know, it's part of the divine dispensation of now, right? That quote-unquote coincidentally I was just speaking of, right? That's the divine dispensation that's always there to be discovered. Someone had forethought here and planned for the future, saved up, you know, this fuel to use when you needed it. Okay? All right, see, so that's the point of that initial little comment. And it's just, again, you notice that, you know, when they say the stage is almost ideally set for the appearance of the first land animals, that's, you know, the biggie is the atmosphere that I was just talking about there, right? That you're transitioning from low enough carbon dioxide and high enough oxygen. Okay.
220 million years ago, many of the continental land areas, including most of North America, were above water. The land was overrun by luxurious vegetation. This was indeed the age of ferns. Carbon dioxide was still present in the atmosphere, but in lessening degree.
I've already basically stated that. See, there's the other half of the, you know, the comment about the two gases. Okay.
Shortly thereafter, the central portion of North America was inundated, creating two great inland seas. Both the Atlantic and Pacific coastal highlands were situated just beyond the present shorelines. These two seas presently united, commingling their different forms of life, and the union of these marine fauna marked the beginning of the rapid and worldwide decline in marine life and the opening of the subsequent land life period.
Okay, so that little foreshadowing there, you know, at this point you don't know what it is, but the next period is the Permian, where there's vast extinction, okay? And they're pointing out that that isn't just a, you know, a punctual event. And I mean, the transition, as I hinted in the first paragraph, has already begun. And coincidentally, there's things like, you know, these two groups of marine life are doing fine in themselves, and then you pour them together, right? And there's all this conflict, and right, it causes, you know, a lot of the species to die off. Just, you know, thinking about how this happens, how that which is no longer part of the truth of the story, right, the facts that are no longer key to the truth of the story fade from view, right? And they do so in various ways. But in one way or another, they do, right? You can say, man, why didn't the life carriers were right there? Why didn't they like build some sort of a barrier so that the two, you know, so that, you know, it kept all the species alive? It's like, you know, think about how we would have, you know, reacted to that situation. You know, we got to spend trillions of dollars to try to build some barrier to prevent these, right? We try to make the facts of time the truths of eternity. And we get more and more desperate in the effort, right? And every time we pile up the sand grains and declare it to be an eternal edifice, the wind blows the sand grains away, right?
That's another truth.
And it's supposed to remind you that, no, the facts of time are not the truths of eternity, right? You're looking in the wrong place, right? They're going to point out, when we get to the Permian, lots of issues along these lines. It all is very natural. I mean, it's not, you know, it's part of an evolutionary process. Mostly, it's not cataclysms, right? And there was a time when, you know, geology started out with uniformitarianism and just religiously rejected catastrophism, okay? You know, but in recent decades, you know, it's crept back in, okay? And now everything is rationalized with catastrophism, right? You know, it's a panacea now. Right, because it's really a primitive religion now, and not science. Right? So everything's Armageddon. Okay?
A meteor killed
all the time. It's a meteor or blah, blah, blah. It's all these catastrophes. In general, no. It's just the evolutionary process, right? And when you're done with the scaffolding, you're done with the scaffolding. Okay? And that's just the way it is. Remember how long way back we read that whole bit about, species continue to exist as long as the mother upholds them, right? The god of evolution. And when she no longer does, they cease to exist. Okay? One way or another. Yeah, and there's a delightful wholeness of coincidentally. Right? See, in supremacy, there are no coincidences. It's not a coincidence that those two seas came together and certain species died out. It's all part of the process.
There is something with the decimal planet part about the actual species that appear.
Right. Just to remind everyone again, decimal world, so there's all the more superfluous species on a decimal world that are going to die off one way or another. Yeah. Because they just aren't, essential to the whole process. In a direct way. I mean, in an indirect way, they're there. Right? They're essential, but not directly. So let's see. The other thing in there, you got to keep note this because we're going to come back to it. See, both the Atlantic and Pacific coastal highlands were situated just beyond the present shorelines. You can't imagine that right now, but there used to be big highlands where now there's, the immediate a continental shelf, on the Pacific and Atlantic sides of North America. There used to be big highlands there back in this time that we'll read about in a little bit when they go away. So you've got this. It's a very different geography than, you can kind of currently picture. All right, let's see. I think we got everything else there, didn't we? Yeah, keep going here.
210 million years ago, the warm water Arctic seas covered most of North America and Europe. The South Polar waters inundated South America and Australia, while both Africa and Asia were highly elevated.
Remember how we mentioned in the preceding session that, Asia often is very highly elevated, right, because it's that kind of core of the original single continent. Obviously we're still in marine climate, warm water Arctic seas, and same for the Antarctic, right? It's basically same temperature all over the whole planet, and it's very mild temperature. So we're still very much in that oceanic or marine climate. Which is kind of hard to wrap your mind around now, to think of, just jumping in to the ocean at the North Pole and delighting in the, beautiful, warm, tropical waters.
It's still dark in winter.
Right, I mean, you still have those issues, but think of how cool it was when the sun never set, and you could swim all day long. You got to be a little bit concerned about some of the things that are in those oceans, though, remember? You'd be a tasty morsel to many of those creatures.
Yeah.
That little point, to just give you that one little tidbit to remind you of the marine climate, okay?
When the seas were at their height, a new evolutionary development suddenly occurred. Abruptly, the first of the land animals appeared. There were numerous species of these animals that were able to live on land or in water. These air-breathing amphibians developed from the arthropods, whose swim bladders had evolved into lungs.
Okay, so we hinted at this before. Remember how we have all the different arthropods, and we had the crustacean type of arthropod, leading to suddenly fishes. We've got a parallel thing coming out of different arthropods, in particular some that had swim bladders, and some amphibians have, primitive swim bladder-like lungs. Okay, so they're just pointing out that linkage. But again, you've got a suddenly, right? You've got an arthropod of some sort, and, you know, it lays eggs, and out of those eggs hatch amphibians of different sorts. You know, there's several parallels suddenlies. You've got all kinds of different amphibians coming out of all sorts of different suddenlies here. Okay. Yeah. So
the fish are they're off on the side. We didn't evolve from fish.
No, I mean, you didn't go from fish to amphibians, right? I mean, you know, currently, I mean, they try to connect the dots like that, you know, they try to go, you know, figure out some way to go, you know. But no, they don't understand that because it's a purpose system and it's purposed universally, you've got this massive parallel phenomenon going on, like we keep stressing, you know. And various parts are coming into existence on various parallel tracks. You know, and, there's a certain thread that ends up going all the way to the will creatures, but there's many parallel tracks on a decimal world, a lot of dead end parallel tracks. But there's also parallel tracks that aren't dead ends, like we just pointed out with the fish. Those are ongoing because obviously the adjutants have an ongoing seeding on some of those non-dead end parallel tracks, you know, not to mention the whole complexities of the ecosystem and stuff, but you want to start by recognizing that first and foremost, things are ongoing because of mind, not because of the details of the material interaction. Right? You know, you want to approach the problem from the top down, the over-control of evolution, mind, and then think about, you know, in the wholeness of the mind, of the mindedness of the situation, then figure out the details of the material facts so that you can sort them out in truth rather than falsehood.
So you imagine life carriers who were watching this got to a point of saying, we're just waiting for that. That's, it's going to happen here anytime.
Right, boom. Right. And
because they understand.
Yep, because they understand, that... You know, sort of when all the prerequisites are in there, and they know that a suddenly is going to be in the not too distant future, right? So when they say the age of frogs, okay, I mean that's just shorthand. I mean, you got all kinds of different amphibians. Right? I mean, for those of you that know the bigger story, you know, why do they single out frogs amongst all the other amphibians? Because the frog line goes to humans, right? Okay.
Tadpoles are fish-like. There never were fish.
Yeah, and they're gonna mention that in just a second. Yep. Okay. Yep. Now the other thing here is there's lots of different ways that you can rationalize splitting the Carboniferous into the Mississippian and the Pennsylvanian. A nice clean way to do it, you know, relative to what you have in the Revelation here, is to do it right here and say that, you know, roughly 210 million years ago, the Mississippian came to an end and the Pennsylvanian began, to separate it by when you have land animals. Abruptly, the first land animals appeared. Okay? To distinguish the Mississippian from the Pennsylvanian, which is kind of one of the basic essence of the difference, no matter how much you argue about exactly where to draw the line, is that there's kind of no land animals before and there's land animals after. So this is a way that you could use a Revelation to just, you know, draw that line if you wanted to have those subdivisions of the Carboniferous, is to do it right here at 210 million years ago. And you notice that they didn't say suddenly the first land animals appeared. They said abruptly, because like I was just pointing out, there's lots of suddenlies.
Right, they're about to go for
one. You know, you've got a whole bunch of parallel suddenlies. We're not just thinking about just one suddenly here, right, but a whole set of them. You know, and they're not all going to be exactly on the same day or something, right? You know, I mean, they're spread out over a little bit of time. But, you know, in relative terms, it's abrupt, right? That you had no amphibians, and shortly thereafter, you got all kinds of different amphibians, okay? You know, and they start to, you know, move onto the land and aggressively, you know, transform what's going on the land from just that purely plant-dominated ecosystem. Okay, let's see. Everything, we got everything there? Yeah, I think so. Let's keep going.
From the briny waters of the seas, there crawled out upon the land snails, scorpions, and frogs. Today, frogs still lay their eggs in water, and their young first exist as little fishes, tadpoles. This period could well be known as the age of frogs.
And so, see, you know, even though, see, they didn't come from fishes, they're reminding you again of the parallel. You know, you kind of had a parallel suddenly that kind of gave you fishes like that other suddenly did, but they're fishes plus. Now, they're only fish-like when they're little, right? And then you're accessing some of the greater potentials, you know, in the DNA to go beyond fishes. So it's like if you just looked at the young, you know, what hatched out of the eggs, it's like, oh, another fish, just like that other suddenly there was a fish. It's like, well, not quite. Watch it for a while, right? It appears to be a fish, but really, it's an amphibian. Okay, so they're getting at that, and see, just think about if you don't appreciate this parallelness and you're trying to sort this all out in the paleontological record, and you go, well, you know, I'm pretty sure frogs, are very similar to us, and tadpoles are like fish, and so that they must go back to fish. See, I mean, it's obvious, why we would, do the dot to dot like we do. See, but it's not true. Right? That's a false interpretation. And you really need revelation to sort such details out, because it's just not immediately apparent. You're easily confused by it. As a scientist. Okay.
So the frogs came from the arthropods too?
Right, so you had all of these different amphibians coming from different arthropods. Right? And they don't explain the details. I mean, one thing you can note is not all amphibians have swim bladder-like lungs. And that complexity has got to be thought about. I mean, there's all kinds of scientific details you'd have to sort out here. But they're giving you the basic clues. Just one little thing. From the briny waters of the seas, they're called out. Why did they throw in the briny waters? Were they just being poetic?
Because they're
salt-based. Right, they're reminding you that they're embodying the salt and carrying it inside their bodies onto the land, right? They're just reminding you of that fact. And you see, we don't just have amphibians. We've got land snails, and we've got scorpions. Remember, they mentioned the scorpions. We had the water scorpions way back, and, they said that eventually you'd get the land scorpions. Here we got them. And if you got scorpions, there's a whole bunch of other creatures that are not too far, behind here. They're not too far in the future. So look what they say next.
Very soon thereafter, the insects first appeared, and together with spiders, scorpions, cockroaches, crickets, and locusts, soon overspread the continents of the world. Dragonflies measured 30 inches across. 1,000 species of cockroaches developed, and some grew to be 4 inches long.
They're still here today.
All right. So insects, we finally have insects. And
frogs got to eat something.
And you go, okay, so why would dragonflies and other insects get so huge?
No bread.
Okay, no, it's not just because of predators, right? It's because of the atmosphere. Because not only do you have, like they said, at the beginning, oxygen starting to go up, but with all of this plant life, oxygen starts to really go up. Okay, it goes up way higher percentage than it is now.
Okay.
Percentage-wise, during the Carboniferous, there was, there was like more than 150% of what the oxygen percentage is now. So a lot more relatively oxygen in the atmosphere back then than now. So arthropods can grow to a lot bigger size, right, and be able to oxygenate themselves, with that higher concentration of oxygen in the atmosphere. So you can get, you can't get insects that big now because there's not enough oxygen in the atmosphere. Right, to support such massive arthropods.
Well, we know how oxygen got in the atmosphere. How does nitrogen get in the atmosphere?
Yeah, well, that's another separate story with that's involved with all those other archaebacteria that are terraforming the planet, and that's kind of an aside that we don't often speak of. But all of that had to be produced in various ways too, from inorganic sources. So you have this incredible thing where, not only do you have all this incredibly dense, massive vegetation, right, that can be supported by the higher levels of carbon dioxide, but that produces a much higher level of oxygen, which can support very massive, creatures. Okay, all right. So it's a very, very dramatic time. And you think about the Garden of Eden-like description, that I started with there. Not a sound was heard, not even the rustle of a leaf, for such trees had no leaves. You're thinking, oh, wow, to just be there in that, infinite peace of that place. And then it's just crawling with gigantic insects and spiders and scorpions. And so it again, see, it speaks to that thing, of Paradise Lost. Right? Right, and it's how you can. This appears to be eternity at the beginning of the Carboniferous. Let us build a tabernacle and stay here forever, Master. Right? And it's like, no, it's not the way it works. And this isn't Havona, and that will be here today and gone tomorrow. So it's that ongoing lesson, that truth that's flowing through all of this.
Does that have the same effect on all creature life, that enhanced oxygen, if it were to stay up?
Yeah, I mean, obviously the more efficient you are at utilizing it. But, obviously when you don't have lungs and stuff, you need to kind of just be bathed in it, right? And the more you're bathed in it, the better. Right, so that's the state you're in.
Is all still just first and second adjutant?
Insects is just first adjutant. Insects are just first adjutant. And that's another thing to point out. You're not always you're not necessarily bringing in a new adjutant. Okay. You're just bringing in a different use of the previous, highest adjutant. But you certainly have the second adjutant with fish. Right? You can figure that out with a goldfish, right? That they have that ability to make basic in the moment associations. Shadow over my goldfish bowl. You're right up there at the surface with your mouth open, because any second now food is going to hit the surface of the water. Right? You've associated that shadow with food hitting the surface of the water. You've used the second adjutant to do that. That obviously isn't something that the first adjutant is bringing out of genetic instinct. Right? they've figured that out since they were bought and put in the goldfish bowl. Right? So they've made an in-the-moment association with the second adjutant. But pretty hard to think of, the energy of loyalty, that energy aspect of the spirit of courage being there in a fish. That seems to be a stretch. Dog, yes. Goldfish, not so much. what about a dogfish? There's always a joker in every crowd. All right, so just, I'm just kind of belaboring this a little bit, it's just because, this is the whole point. I mean, it's just a bunch of dry facts, it appears. But see, we reflect on them and start to get the flow of what's going on. All right.
Two groups of echinoderms became especially well developed, and they are in reality the guide fossils of this epoch. The large shell-feeding sharks were also highly evolved. and for more than 5 million years they dominated the oceans. The climate was still mild and equable. The marine life was little changed. Freshwater fish were developing, and the trilobites were nearing extinction. Corals were scarce, and much of the limestone was being made by the crinoids. The finer building limestones were laid down during this epoch.
All right, so they mentioned the echinoderms at the beginning. You've got, you know, you have these sea lilies, stone lilies, crinoids that are behind a lot of these beautiful, you know, denser limestones. Obviously, you know, if it's a really, you know, coarse limestone, it's not going to make great building stuff because it's going to fall apart. You know, you want something that's more fine-grained and made out of finer creature debris, right? talking about finer creature debris, I mean, you've got sharks that have, you know, grinding teeth, so they can grab a hold of, you know, shell creatures and grind, you know, the shells to, you know, dust, right? And eat them all, you know, shell and all. That's what they're talking about there. So you got these great big sharks with grinding teeth, yeah. Grind your bones to, you know, like fee-fi-fo-thumb, fee-fi-fo-fum, right? You know, the old thing, right? Right, there were sharks that did that. But you see, they're stressing again, the climate was still mild and equable. Right, we still have this very much marine climate. So just adding to not just the atmospheric things, but that very temperate climate, obviously, is just going to foster all the creatures just exploding, right? I mean, everything is just so idyllic, you know, for them to just be prolific beyond belief, right? All right, let's see. Anything else there? I think we got it all. One little thing. When they say things like guide fossils, that's a little aside that, you know, a lot of times that's how they'll try to mark off different parts of the geologic strata. Like, well, when you see this fossil appear, you know, that's the beginning of the such and so. And, right, I mean, that's one of the ways that they've tried to organize it and be able to distinguish, you know, is this before or after the beginning of the such and so? As they use guide fossils like that. Yeah, yeah. Okay.
The waters of many of the inland seas were so heavily charged with lime and other minerals as greatly to interfere with the progress and development of many marine species. Eventually, the seas cleared up as the result of an extensive stone deposit, in some places containing zinc and lead.
Again, you know, that little bit with sometimes you've got issues with the nature of the marine ecosystem and you transitioned into a better state by doing things like getting all of those minerals out of the water, getting them locked, sequestered into rock. We've seen that a little bit before. You know, they're throwing in a number of things like that just so you can appreciate the complexity and how many things could shift a little bit and make it very problematic for certain species so they would die off, you know, on moss and, I mean, there's all these little fluctuations that can have huge effects. And that's why, you know, they're not even remotely mentioning, but as you study the fossil record, I mean, there's just all kinds of extinction events that are just going on all the time for all these various reasons. And, you know, the salinity is not quite, you know, what it needs to be, or the mineral content's not quite what it needs to be, or the water temperature is not what it needs to be, or, we've just mixed two species that are incompatible because these two seas join together. All these different things cause all kinds of extinctions all the time.
The pH would change dramatically with carbon dioxide.
Yeah, right. All right. All those issues, right? Yeah. Yeah. It's a very, very complex system.
The deposits of this early Carboniferous age are from 500 to 2,000 feet thick, consisting of sandstone, shale, and limestone. The oldest strata yield the fossils of both land and marine animals and plants, along with much gravel and basin sediments. Little workable coal is found in these older strata. These depositions throughout Europe are very similar to those laid down over North America.
Let's see. Got some of the basics there. Like I was pointing out, how there's some of that differential in terms of the life that you find in the early part of the Carboniferous relative to the latter part. You see there. Speaking to that. And then you've got, they're about to get to it more specifically. You have this issue of when things really get going with laying down lots of vegetation that's eventually going to become beds of coal. And we're just getting here to the point where that's going to start to kick into high gear. Okay? All right.
It's kind of fun how they describe it as workable coal, very suggestive. Yeah, you're going to want some coal that you can work with.
Right. I mean, you know, there's coal, but, you know, okay, got these thin little beds, you know, and they're way down, and, you know, it's, you know, not a very...
motherboat.
Yeah, it's not economically mineable, right?
Coal miners.
Yeah.
Just to solidify the understanding that this is intended for use.
Yes. Right. Yeah. Again, very much. Yeah, you see that.
Mistake.
Yep. Okay.
Toward the close of this epoch, the land of North America began to rise. There was a short interruption, and the seas returned to cover about half of its previous beds. This was a short inundation, and most of the land was soon well above water. South America was still connected with Europe by way of Africa.
Yeah, you see, they're giving you all these little details, so when you're studying, you go... Oh, okay, yeah, I know what they're talking about there. I know about how there was a short interruption. Okay, so they pinned that down for me. That, you know, without having to have anything to date, I know that's somewhere between 210 and 200 million years ago. Right? They're giving all these little fact points like that, stuff that you could identify, as you're studying the details. Right? So those are just helps for the eventual... proper scientific perspective on an interpretation on all the details. You know, kind of like the guide fossil sort of stuff, right? Yeah. You know, these little benchmarks of pinning things down.
Marker dots.
Yeah, little marker dots, yeah. Okay?
This epoch witnessed the beginning of the Vosges, Black Forest, and Ural Mountains. Stumps of other and older mountains are to be found all over Great Britain and Europe.
And the Vosges Mountains are in northeastern France. And then you've got the Black Forest, of course, that's down in southwestern Germany. And the Urals over there in Russia, you know, dividing Europe and the Asia parts of Russia, you know, Europe to the west and Asia to the east of the Ural Mountains. And remember, again, we're still in this mode where it isn't full-on technically plate tectonics, but you'll see, and they say other things here as we go forward, we are definitely transitioning. It's the crust is getting more rigid. And you notice in the title, they said the crustal shifting stage. Okay, so, you know, you start to think about it starts to get a bit more rigid, but it's still kind of just in the mode where it's, you know, flexing about and stuff. Things could start to get a little bit more brittle and break and shift and, you know, rather than just kind of quasi-fluidly shifting about, right? And so, you know, we'll start to see... you know, a little bit more mountain-like rather than just big highland sorts of stuff happening because things are getting more brittle. So that's what they're hinting at there.
Okay, where's the brittleness coming from?
Because it's cooling.
Okay.
Right, the crust is continuing to cool and solidify.
Yeah.
Slowly, slowly, slowly.
Rocks.
So rather than because the crust is getting thicker because of deposition.
I mean, there's all those issues. I mean, there's all those complexities too. But
it's mostly cooling.
But the big thing is, yeah, that you know, you're cooling. Yeah.
200 million years ago, the really active stages of the Carboniferous period began. For 20 million years prior to this time, the earlier coal deposits were being laid down. But now, the more extensive coal formation activities were in process. The length of the actual coal deposition epoch was a little over 25 million years.
Okay, so the point of that last sentence is, you were 200 million years ago, the Carboniferous comes to an end at 180 million years ago. So as I said, you know, so it would appear, see, that it's 20 million years, but he said the length of the actual coal deposition epoch is a little over 25 million. So actually, this very significant coal deposition part of the Carboniferous started about 5 million years before this point. Okay, so that's just reminding you there. So when we were reading above there, you know, this had already begun, really starting to lay down lots and lots of vegetable debris. And very significant heaps. In an ongoing fashion, not just, well, a little, and then things change, but just laying it down and laying it down and laying it down. So eventually you're going to have a great big thick seam of coal. Okay? Obviously it's going to require the land not being, every 10 seconds, oscillating back and forth between now it's underwater, now it's above water, now it's underwater. So things have got to be a little bit settled for a longer span of time. And we've been building up in ever greater expressions of plant density, right? It's just going and going and going, getting denser and denser plant life to die and fall down into piles. So you got those basic facts there that now we're really going to see when the stuff that's going to be future energy for humans being laid down. And what word do they throw in? Right? That sentence starts out, 200 million years ago, the really active stages of the Carboniferous period began. Do they not really know how to use, pardon the pun, the word really? They really mean very. The very active stages, like we use the word really when we really mean very. No.
They didn't like that.
Of course not. And that should catch, like, whoa, wait a minute. Okay? The word really is in the midst of this. You can do a search, okay? That word is out of the blue in the midst of all these historical geology papers. Okay? Because when you say really, reality, when I go from potential to actual to real, if I realityize myself, if I realityize an aspect of my mindful self, that means I'm synchronizing that self with eternity. What they're saying there is that the grace of eternity is manifesting in time very actively now. Right? The grace of eternity. Right? By grace, there's coal beds for humans to use in the future. Right? Very purposeful use of the word really there. You can see they even contrasted the length of the actual coal deposition. They don't mean actual, they mean real. Okay? So just to stress what I was saying, why they call it the Carboniferous, the truth that's in play here, very profoundly now, the truths of eternity are really very obviously manifest the grace of eternity. is there to be recognized. You know, and the degree to which, you know, you've fallen into current traps of demonizing fossil fuels. They're trying to challenge you on that. It's not like the revelers just don't know what kind of foolishness we were going to be thinking a few decades hence, right? And how we'd get ourselves wrapped around the axle. You know, you have to constantly challenge yourself that now is a divine dispensation. Right? You have to know that really now is divine. No matter how much it apparently is not. Because if you start believing that the appearance is reality, right, you're projecting yourself outward and declaring that you are the source of reality. Right? And that's problematic. Right? Depending on how zealous you are about that, that only goes one place, ultimately, and that's iniquity. Right? I mean, that's the seeds of self-righteousness, right? That false belief that, you know, things on the planet right now are going to hell in a handbasket or something. No, it just appears that way, right? You have to know that it really isn't, despite all appearances of the contrary. And until you know that it isn't really as it appears, you don't have religion. Because that's what religion gives you, right? Religion is bound back. The RE is back. Bound back to eternity, right? Like you're talking about with really, right? You know, you look at now from an eternity vantage point, so you know unshakably, right, that now is a divine dispensation. Because now is a downstepped expression of eternity and time. You know the truth of now, despite all of the facts that appear to be in defiance of that truth. Do you live your life that way? Or are you railing against your illusion? Right? You project yourself outward and believe that that's reality, and oh my gosh, if you know, a reality like that needs to, you have to rise up against that. Yep.
Okay, but you have said
about
we go into light and light, and we were in that section about we become an architectural sphere in a way.
Right.
So, mankind, sons of God, eventually get to a point, I would imagine, where they, you know, sort of act, you know, more in a more godlike fashion, because they try to become more and more like God as humans in organizing the planet and doing, helping things with nature.
Yes.
Things out.
Right.
So it's not
more
to get to a point of where.
Yeah. See, and to get to that point is getting to the point where you clearly distinguish truth from fact and hence reality from appearance. Right? And you act based upon what you know the reality of the situation is. You don't act based upon the appearance of the situation. Right? You know, eventually, we will have that skill, that wisdom, insight, and foresight. You know, and we can act hand in hand with the planetary administrators. You know, we will have the same depth of recognition of truth that they do. Remember, eventually you get up where you can act hand in hand with the Ancients of Days, like that, and vice versa, right? They go, oh, you have plenty of depth of recognition. God doesn't need to do this anymore. You can do it. And the Ancients of Days hands you a job. It's like, phew, I don't have to do that anymore. Because John finally got himself up to par. Right? Right?
It was worth waiting for.
But, yeah, I mean, see, that, you know, right now, we're we're setting up an emergency state, you know, that gave us a fifth epical revelation, you know, because we're not acting upon reality. We're acting upon appearance, right? And we are driving ourselves erroneously off into the ditch. You know, we need to get back to the pursuit of truth and not the declaration that you are truth. You know, and it starts with simple things. You know, don't start with truth. Start with goodness. Okay? Then think about your definition of goodness. Do you define goodness to be, well, if it's a pleasant stimulus to me, it's good. Is that how you use the word good? And a stimulus that's not pleasant to me is bad. Is that how you declare the spiritual nature of something? Good and bad are spirit words, right? I mean, think about
maybe
love.
These are primitive.
Love is the desire to do good to others. Or Jesus went about doing good. Okay, do you know what the definition of the word good is? So that you can properly interpret those two statements? Right? I mean, again, if goodness is defined relative to your subjective experiences, what are you going about doing? You know, oh, I'm going about doing good. I'm going about believing that I define the nature of reality, and I'm trying to mold it into my image, and so it's pleasant to me. And you declare that to be good. I mean, seriously, people. You know, and if you can't start to get an objective definition of goodness in your mind, you're never going to get to truth, because truth is a super additive consequence of a relationship between fact and goodness. Right? And then, of course, you know, you could even try lower hanging fruit. How about fact? Do you discriminate between fact and figment?
Yeah, not these days.
All right. Again, you know, you have a figment in your mind and you project it outward as fact. You have a notion in your mind and you project it outward as goodness. Right? And you have a notion in your mind and you project it outward, okay, but it's falsehood, and you call it truth. You gotta back up, right, and get yourself grounded again and get yourself humble again. You've got to get yourself out of the center of the universe. Right? The definition of goodness has nothing to do with you. Right? Now, what does the revelation say so many times? Right? Things like that which you declare to be definitively good is probably horrendously bad. Like winning the lottery. Right? Say. Right? That fortune of time, you know, it appears to be good. You know, it's really bad, right? It actually causes you to break from any relationship to the unity of the situation. And your life implodes because of it. You know, because you are not unity. You're dependent upon a relationship to unity to maintain a continuousness in your life.
Right? There's a golden rule, too. There's certain things about what... If it's relative, then you've got to do.
See,
if we're how far and where you are, I mean, it's better to do what you feel is good, even if it maybe isn't necessarily
right. I mean, there's no problem with a child of God starting very subjectively and interpreting the golden rule. How does Jesus teach you about the levels of meaning? He uses the golden rule as an illustration. He says, "Let's think about the golden rule, moving it up to six levels of meaning." The little child starts interpreting the golden rule on the first level of meaning. Right? You want to get up to interpreting on the sixth level of meaning. And remember, basically no one in human history is interpreted above the second level. So you've got your work cut out for you to get up to the sixth level of interpreting the golden rule. See, I just interpreted for you on the second level of meaning, like everyone does. Well, this feels pleasant to me, right, on the second level of meaning, the level of the feelings. Therefore, it's good.
Pleasant, good.
Right? Have you, you know, good is a spirit word. It only is defined on the sixth level of meaning. You can't know it on the second level of meaning.
In fact, we just use that word everywhere. We just slander it everywhere.
Right, and it's gotten worse and worse. Over the last 100 years, it's gotten worse and worse. We use the word good for everything now. Right? A complete corruption. I mean, we barely, you know, are holding it up at the second level of meaning. It's becoming more commonly used on the first level of meaning now.
However,
the level of the flesh.
If their desire is there to be good, you know, you will eventually, that meaning will eventually grow. If you don't have the desire at all, then you're kind of...
You have to have the desire, and you have to never be satisfied. The key is to, you know, I mean, there is a truth to goodness on the levels below the sixth. The fact of it, though, is up on the sixth. And so, but you just have to, you find the truth of it on the second level of meaning, but you're not satisfied. You say, okay, this is great, but I know there's better. I don't know what I mean by that, but I know there's always better. I'm not going to be fundamentally satisfied with my current understanding, you know, or relationship to this. I'm going to seek a higher relationship. Hunger and thirst for righteousness, right? Never be satisfied. That's the key, right? You know, and you got to have humility, right? To always be hungry like that. I mean, so that's the key, right? I'm not denying the truth of your nature as a child of God, but God expects us to eventually grow up. Right? We got to move up. Right? And that's the whole point. Okay, so back to the Carboniferous here now. Okay, so you'll see here in the next paragraph that they actually highlight the word Carboniferous. See, like I said, it's in the wake of we've gotten to the meat of the truth, the really active. So that's what they. So now they go to the next statement here.
The land was periodically going up and down due to the shifting sea level occasioned by activities on the ocean bottoms. This crustal uneasiness, the settling and rising of the land in connection with the prolific vegetation of the coastal swamps, contributed to the production of extensive coal deposits, which have caused this period to be known as the Carboniferous. And the climate was still mild the world over.
It's like, wow, they said it again. I'm starting to suspect that, I bet you scientists don't believe that. Right? Yeah, remember we hinted that way back when they were talking about the red sandstone? And you know, you're interpreting, oh, that must be due to an arid climate. You know, no, it's not. No, right. Yeah, I mean, if you look at the way scientists try to rationalize all this stuff, you know, they have a continental climate sort of rationalization scheme going way, way back, right? And so they keep stressing this, you know, so because the scientists think, are we at continental climate yet? No, not yet. And the climate was still mild the world over. Right, well, how about now? Are we there yet? Right? It's like a little kid, and so they have to keep repeating it. No, not yet. So any rationalizations you scheme you have about these times where there's a continental climate, that's a false scheme. Doesn't matter how holistically you've rationalized the whole picture, it's false. Okay. Okay. like I said, see, you know, the italicized Carboniferous. Because we see we're at this point, we're really at the truth of that. You could wonder why. Why didn't they make that statement, you know, up at the front of this section? Why did they wait till right here? Trying to just stress, it's here where you really begin to see the truth manifest as a fact in time. Great, big, thick, wonderful beds of power. Right?
The coal layers alternate with shale, stone, and conglomerate. These coal beds over central and eastern United States vary in thickness from 40 to 50 feet, but many of these deposits were washed away during subsequent land elevations. In some parts of North America and Europe, the coal-bearing strata are 1,800 feet in thickness.
No, 18,000.
18,000 feet in thickness.
Yeah. All right. But, you know, as I just point out, I mean, that's not a single, you know, right. You know, lots and lots of little, you know, beds interleaved. Shale, stone, and conglomerate. You know, stone is just shorthand for sandstone and limestone. You know, either one. Okay. But you notice there's vicissitudes. You get this nice coal all stored up. And then erosion washes it all away in some places. So it's not like this magical little thing where the magic man waves his wand and there's these fancy, eternal, untouched beds of coal waiting, you know, unassailed. No, it's all part of the evolutionary process. There's vicissitudes to everything.
But if there weren't these inundations periodically,
mm-hmm.
all of the coal would have been washed away.
Right, all that complexity. And they're reminding you, as they're going to point out in a second, you know, remember, this all has to happen, you know, in bog, swamp-like land, you know, where this stuff is getting laid down. You know, continents are big and, you know, everything isn't a swamp. Yeah. But if it's pretty low land, you know, like we pointed out, there's a lot of these areas don't have much in elevation. So, you know, that can be pretty extensive, you know, swampy-like land. And if it isn't swamp right now, wait a little while for a different undulation and it'll be swamp, you know, later. Right? Okay.
The presence of roots of trees as they grew in the clay underlying the present coal beds demonstrates that coal was formed exactly where it is now found. Coal is the water-preserved and pressure-modified remains of the rank vegetation growing in the bogs and on the swamp shores of this faraway age. Coal layers often hold both gas and oil. Peat beds, the remains of past vegetable growth, would be converted into a type of coal if subjected to proper pressure and heat. Anthracite has been subjected to more pressure and heat than other coal.
Okay, so you've got the basic process, and you know, you can see how that paragraph opens. You know, they're definitely trying to guide people away from some false rationalization scheme about where fossil fuels come from. Right? You know, and there's still people that try to put forward other rationalization schemes. No, it's really straightforward. You got bogs and swamps and the stuff just piles up, right? You know, notice that, you know, you can literally see this tree, you know, with its roots down in the clay below and, you know, and it's, you know, up into the coal, you know, and don't go off on, you know, crazy schemes. It's very straightforward how it happens. You know, so you start out with peat, right? And as they're hinting at, would be converted into a type of coal. Okay? Right? I mean, eventually that peat gets put under enough heat and pressure that you have that most primitive form, lignite. Yeah, like you have up in North Dakota and eastern Montana, say, right? Lots of lignite. If it gets a little bit more cooked, right, if you will, you'll get sub-bituminous coal. You got lots of sub-bituminous coal in Wyoming, say. A little bit more, you have just straight bituminous coal. A lot of the stuff... you know, extensive regions east of the Mississippi. You know, there's lots of bituminous coal, for instance. And then if you take it all the way to the point where it's basically getting metamorphosed, you know, to being like a metamorphic rock, you know, you have anthracite. Okay? So you got that whole spectrum of coal, you know, from lignite that you can, you know, look at, and it's like, wow, I can see that this was a tree, right? It's been turned into a chunk of, you know, of simple coal, right? It still looks like a tree, you know, all the way up to something that looks like, you know, this very hard, shiny rock, you know, of anthracite, okay? Okay, so the whole spectrum, starting with peat beds.
In North America, the layers of coal in the various beds which indicate the number of times the land fell and rose, vary from 10 in Illinois, 20 in Pennsylvania, 35 in Alabama, to 75 in Canada. Both fresh and saltwater fossils are found in the coal beds.
You know, speaking of Pennsylvania, you know, you can definitely find anthracite in Pennsylvania, for instance.
Isn't that the more desirable?
Yeah, I mean, you know, anthracite burns, you know, very clean, you know. You know, bituminous coal, you know, you got a lot of smoke and you end up with tar residue and stuff. That's why it's called bituminous. And, you know, so, right, I mean, it's, you know, but there isn't that much anthracite. Okay, it's pretty uncommon that it's gotten all the way to that state of metamorphosis. Okay, and also remember a lot of the coal... you know, like say even the, you know, bituminous and subbituminous coal in Wyoming, I mean, that's much more recent than this stuff. You know, that's not from the Carboniferous. You know, that's from later deposits.
The coal that we see in big trains.
Yeah, you know, coming down from around Gillette, right? That subbituminous coal, most likely.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
That's not anthracite.
Oh, no, no, no. You know, and so it's got, you know, it's got a lot of issues that, you know, that's a whole bit of clean coal technology, trying to, you know, make it so that you can burn that lesser grade coal without so much unwanted, you know, side effects.
I was under the impression that some of the better coal was in the West rather than in the East.
It's just really handy because, you know, I mean, some of it, you just, you know, it's a, there's just a foot of sod on top of it, and then there's just, you know, endless feet of, you know, of like lignite, you know, or whatever. But, you know, so it's easy to strip mine and whatnot. You don't have to have guys crawling down into holes. And, but no, I mean, there's, you know, the higher grade coal, the less there is, basically, right? And the, you know, and the deeper it tends to be and stuff, you know, unless it's gotten, you know, up close to the surface through erosion and whatnot. But, you know, it's just like you're not likely to find a diamond, you know, laying in a stream bed. You know, those things don't form, you know, under the pressure of trickling water. Right? You got to have really high pressure and stuff to form such things. So, yeah. Same way with anthracite, you got to have it pretty deep down. Okay, so, and then, you know, just they're giving you those facts to, you know, again, to just appreciate how much fluctuation there was, you know, and how low-lying some of this, how Florida-like, right, some of this stuff is, you know, that it's just, you know, just sitting there bobbing around above and below sea level just a little bit for millions and millions and millions of years, and, it's bogs, now it's under water, and it gets some, you know, sandstone laid on top of it. Okay, now we're up above water again, and you get some more, you know, another bog, and then it's down, and you get some limestone laid on it, and it's just, you know, on and on you go. All right, keep going. Oh, is there a question?
Yeah, John Stevens wonders if you could address the 75 layers in Canada.
If I can...
Address the 75 layers in Canada?
Oh, see, again, just, you know, I, you know, just thinking about how, like I was saying, how low-lying and how fluctuating a lot of that area was. And it's just, you know, it's just sitting there oscillating above and below water over and over and over and over and over again over these 25 million years or more, right? Yeah, it's just, it all just depends upon, you know, coincidence of which areas, you know, had the most frequent opportune circumstances to lay down significant peat beds. Yeah. Okay.
Throughout this epoch, the mountains of North and South America were active. Both the Andes and the southern ancestral Rocky Mountains rising. The great Atlantic and Pacific high coastal regions began to sink, eventually becoming so eroded and submerged that the coastlines of both oceans withdrew to approximately their present positions. The deposits of this inundation averaged average about 1,000 feet in thickness.
See, like I said, how we're obviously getting closer to, you know, they're hinting at how you're starting to get stuff that's, you know, more what you would properly call mountains, even if we aren't literally to plate tectonics yet. You know, and like I mentioned, I think it was last session, you obviously have volcanic activity, right, that can definitely produce mountains, right? And they're pointing out, so you've got these huge coastal ranges that are now are just continental shelves, totally gone. And so for the first time, when you finally got rid of those, you could have inundations into the continent coming sideways, rather than, you notice, you know, they've been frequently talking about how it's been coming, you know, a lot from the north and south, you know, rather than east and west. But now you can have inundation in, you know, into the continent coming from the sides if you finally erode away those barriers. Okay, and have things, you know, so the stage is now set on the coasts to produce, you know, begin to produce the kind of mountains that we see there now. Okay.
190 million years ago witnessed a westward extension of the North American Carboniferous Sea over the present Rocky Mountain region, with an outlet to the Pacific Ocean through Northern California. Coal continued to be laid down throughout the Americas and Europe, layer upon layer, as the coastlands rose and fell during these ages of seashore oscillations.
See, so just a tiny little paragraph about 190 million years ago, because the basic truth is still in play. They just give you a couple of fact points, like I said, for the geologists, you know, to pin down some specific things, you know, like if you pin down, you know, that those issues with, you know, an outlet to the Pacific Ocean through Northern California, you know, that sort of stuff, helping you to have an actual date for those things. All right, but see, now even though we haven't gotten to the end of the section, we have gotten to the end of the Carboniferous, and it ends at 180 million years ago. So those 25 million years of very definitive laying down of coal is coming to an end here.
180 million years ago brought the close of the Carboniferous period, during which coal had been formed all over the world, in Europe, India, China, North Africa, and the Americas. At the close of the coal formation period, North America east of the Mississippi Valley rose, and most of this section has ever since remained above the sea. This land elevation period marks the beginning of the modern mountains of North America, both in the Appalachian regions and in the West. Volcanoes were active in Alaska and California and in the mountain-forming regions of Europe and Asia. Eastern America and Western Europe were connected by the continent of Greenland.
Yes, now remember, again, we aren't in a plate tectonic thing, and so, you know, we still kind of have the one continent, but, you know, just kind of spread out a bit, you know, with inland seas and what have you. And, you know, and when they may say the continent of Greenland, don't think the little Greenland they have now, but, you know, think of an extensive region that is, you know, that would really be there connecting, you know, Europe and Northern Europe and Northern North America, right? You know, and the current Greenland is just what's left, you know, of a more extensive, higher region of land. Coincidentally, there was coal was formed all over the world, because probably there's going to be people all over the world, and initially they don't get along with each other, and they all need their separate piles of coal. Just, you know, why are they, you know, ask the question, why did they just tell me that little tidbit there, right? Beyond the immediate fact of it. And this whole bit about east and west of the Mississippi, you know, if you look at, you know, where the coal is that we mine, you know, you can see this very definite differential of what kind of coal you have to the east of the Mississippi relative to the west of the Mississippi, basically. And so they're pointing out how you had that that land elevation evolution really caused that differential like that. Let's see.
We would call Greenland a subcontinent now.
Yeah.
Right. And then here they're calling it a continent.
Right. And you'll see that they add to that here in a little bit. That's why I was stressing that. You don't have an Atlantic Ocean back then like you have now. Okay. That deep, very definitive separation between the two sides of the pond, quote unquote, right? All right.
Land elevation began to modify the marine climate of the preceding ages and to substitute, therefore, the beginnings of the less mild and more variable continental climate.
We're there. Finally.
Finally.
Right. All right. So finally now, and that's the big issue. We've got continental climate beginning to happen. That's going to have consequences. Okay, keep going.
The plants of these times were spore-bearing, and the wind was able to spread them far and wide. The trunks of the carboniferous trees were commonly 7 feet in diameter and often 125 feet high. The modern ferns are truly relics of these bygone ages.
See, you got a big clod of wood there to make coal out of. And there's millions and millions and millions of them, right? See, so, and you notice they've gotten bigger and bigger, right? Over the course of it, right? We're up to 125 feet now. Huge in diameter, right? Okay. Yeah, so... just to, wrap your mind around how it is that you can have these massive coal beds. It's because you've got this incredible vegetation everywhere. Okay?
In general, these were the epochs of development for freshwater organisms. Little change occurred in the previous marine life. But the important characteristic of this period was the sudden appearance of the frogs and their many cousins. The life features of the coal age were ferns and frogs.
Yeah. And like I stressed, they keep focusing on frogs because that's the most immediate pre-human fact, right, that's in play. The cousins, not so much. Right? All right, so you see that the big in terms of what's going on in the water, the big thing that is growing is more and more freshwater stuff, and so there's opportunity for more horizontal evolution relative to freshwater environs. But the saltwater stuff is kind of just chugging along like it's been for tens and tens of millions of years here now, as we've been reading this story. Okay, but now things are going to get very different.
Section 6, the climatic transition stage, the seed plant period, the age of biologic tribulation. This period marks the end of pivotal evolutionary development in marine life and the opening of the transition period leading to the subsequent ages of land animals.
He's stressing that again. The evolutionary process is shifting modes. Basically the biggest fashion possible. And really shifting from marine to land. So don't be surprised if there isn't great tribulation involved with such transitions. The very fact that you use tribulation, you immediately see the obvious parallels, right? When they talk about this next 1,000 years, right? Before things settle down in terms of civilization a little bit more, right? Don't expect it to be 1,000 years of quasi light and life. It's going to be more like the Permian period that we're about to read about. Okay, that's the more appropriate analogy. Is this going to be like the Trinity Teacher Son Age? You know, no. Think the Permian period. Very significant transition. You know, the transition from the early stages of the progress of civilization to the advancing stages of the progress of civilization, especially when you've got rebellion and default. Yeah. Think the Permian. Just an aside, you know, we're about to read about the Permian. Here's where Permian is after Perm, which is a city in the European part of Russia, you know, to the west of the Urals. So, you know, we had all those ones that were place names or people names that were related to whales. You know? So you can see we're kind of expanding out. We're bringing in Russia here now. You know, and of course, if we used Mississippian and Pennsylvanian for the previous, right, I mean, we were leaving Wales behind there too. And so, just gives you some sense of where you might find some of the, you know, as they said, you know, back here, the guide fossils, right? Yeah, you know, or, you know, the classic beds or the classic fossils. You know, obviously these names are going to have something to do with that, those issues. Okay, let's see what we got here.
This age was one of great life impoverishment. Thousands of marine species perished, and life was hardly yet established on land. This was a time of biologic tribulation, the age when life nearly vanished from the face of the earth and from the depths of the oceans. Toward the close of the long marine life era, there were more than 100,000 species of living things on Earth. The close of this period of transition, less than 500 had survived.
Gosh, I hope that's not a truth.
Okay. Right. So, I mean, the Permian extinction, you know, is definitely known to be very significant, but that's even more. I mean, you know, look at that. You're, you know, less than a half a percent, okay, more than 99.5% gone, scaffolding. Wisdom needs to be injected into the biologic system. And the only way wisdom can come about is through tribulation. Okay. All right, so, you know, we're in desperate need of wisdom on this planet. Therefore, we're in desperate need of tribulation. Because that's the only way you can get wisdom.
I thought we were in desperate need of revelation.
Yeah, but you know how that works. Revelation without wisdom is a doorstop. All right. Okay. All right, so that's... That just gives you a taste of just how radical, you know, this can be. And you'll see how they talk about this going forward here.
The peculiarities of this new period were not due so much to the cooling of the Earth's crust or to the long absence of volcanic action as to an unusual combination of commonplace and pre-existing influences. Restrictions of the seas and increasing elevation of enormous land masses. The mild marine climate of former times was disappearing, and the harsher continental type of weather was fast developing.
So all the rationalization schemes that people are still flailing about with, right? No, it's the basic fact that you're transitioning from marine to continental climate. Okay, it's climate change. Okay.
What was directly responsible for most of the tribulation and most of the loss of species?
Yep. Yeah, see, and you know, same, you know, you notice how they started talking about volcanoes and stuff, you know, say, no, it's not because, yeah, in some places you got lots of volcanoes and stuff, but that's not the big issue. You know, and it's also not that, you know, the cooling of the Earth's crust, like I said, see, that's the big thing, that it's cooling and it is getting more rigid, and that's causing a little bit more dramatic sorts of stuff to happen some, but that's not the big issue. You know, and it's not massive meteor impacts or anything like that.
Water got cold.
Right. A lot of water got cold, you know, and because, you know, the currents couldn't flow like they used to. And, you know, like they're saying, you start to get a lot more continents and, you know, the ocean can't flow as freely as it used to. And so it starts to get pockets of different temperature and, you know, and whatnot. Yeah. So that's the big issue is it's the humans needing a place to stand, needing dry land, caused the death of over 99.5% of the creatures on the Earth, so you could have a place to stand. And you think that humans have a big impact today? Right. We'll never have as much impact as we had back in the Permian. Right. It makes the flood story in the Bible, you know, sound pretty limited. Right? there was no Noah to save, you know, one of each of the 100,000. No, they all just died. Okay.
170 million years ago, great evolutionary changes and adjustments were taking place over the entire face of the Earth. Land was rising all over the world as the ocean beds were sinking. Isolated mountain ridges appeared. The eastern part of North America was high above the sea. The west was slowly rising. The continents were covered by great and small salt lakes and numerous inland seas, which were connected with the oceans by narrow straits. The strata of this transition period vary in thickness from 1,000 to 7,000 feet.
See, again, the cooling crust thing. Isolated mountain ridges appeared. Okay, see, it's getting a little bit more localized because things are getting more brittle. It doesn't have such broad scope. You know, it can start to, you know, get more localized as it's getting more and more rigid. And it's still flexing about. Yeah. Okay.
The Earth's crust folded extensively during these land elevations. This was a time of continental emergence, except for the disappearance of certain land bridges, including the continents which had so long connected South America with Africa and North America with Europe.
See, right there. You're really starting to get the Atlantic Ocean, right? A very submerged, you know, region between North and South America, you know, between the Americas and Europe and Africa. Before that, it was really kind of all just one continent, like I said, right? And, you know, you had stuff in the middle there that, you know, you totally don't have anymore. It's just completely collapsed and is gone and is a seafloor now, right? So if you want to think about, some truth to, you know, the old Greek stories about Atlantis out there somewhere, you know, beyond the Straits of Gibraltar, well, you can go way back here to 170 million years ago, okay? There were continents out there that did sink.
So is that rock granite or basalt? I mean, that was initially granite.
Well, initially you had all the granite, but see, you know, it just got totally worn away and washed away, and, you know, it's just all gone. Everything is just completely gone.
So when you look at South America and Africa now, it looked like they almost fit together. That really wasn't the case then.
Well, no, see, it was. It's just that
they've moved apart since then, either?
Well, they're just pointing out that you had a definite parallel opening, and it's just the stuff in the middle sunk out.
It's disappeared. Because when you look at satellite maps of, you know, of,
right,
having mapped under the ocean. You see, right, look at,
see,
it.
Don't think magical continental submersion. It's not like, you know, you're going down an elevator and somewhere down in the Atlantic Ocean is this whole submerged continent. No, it's just all gone. You know, any more than there's, you know, those old mountain ranges, you know, if you will, on the two sides of North America. No, it's just completely gone. It's just been totally washed away. And there's nothing there. You know, if you try to find the geography that they're talking about, you know, back a million years ago with Annan and Fonta and stuff, no, you're not going to find something that they're talking about that's now submerged. That stuff is just totally gone. Right? It's just, there's nothing left of it. You know, there's just seafloor there. You know, no hint that there was ever land there. So you got to think in really radical, you know, terms. Okay.
The Earth's crust folded. I read that already.
Let's see, where were we?
Gradually.
Yeah, gradually, yep, yep.
The inland lakes and seas were drying up all over the world. Isolated mountain and regional glaciers began to appear, especially over the southern hemisphere. And in many regions, the glacial deposit of these local ice formations may be found even among some of the upper and later coal deposits. Two new climatic factors appeared, glaciation and aridity. Many of the Earth's higher regions had become arid and barren.
See, now you can have arid regions, finally, not way back then. And you can, you know, you don't have continental scale glaciation, and that's not going to happen until 2 million years ago. But you're starting to have, you know, a lot of, you know, even regional sort of scale glaciation. And you could find that regional glaciation and falsely extrapolate it and think it was, you know, covering whole continents or something like that, but it wasn't. Okay. Okay, so, you know, they're giving you some of those clues so that you don't go off on false tangents. Because, again, you, a lot of times, it appears that it maybe was covering, say, the whole continent, but you can't tell for sure because all that other stuff was washed away, and you're just falsely extrapolating. And they're saying, yeah, you are falsely extrapolating. Yeah. Okay.
Throughout these times of climatic change, great variations also occurred in the land plants. The seed plants first appeared, and they afforded a better food supply for the subsequently increased land animal life. The insects underwent a radical change. The resting stages evolved to meet the demands of suspended animation during winter and drought.
So you got this whole, during the Permian tribulation, you got all of these horizontal evolution aspects that are coming in. You know, for hibernation and various suspended animation sorts of things and all sorts of plants and animals. And, you know, like having a little plant that can blow along like a tiny little tumbleweed thing across, you know, endless miles of desert until it happens to fall into a little puddle and then it puts down roots and sprouts up again. You know, the ability to have things like that. And, you know, you've seen all kinds of stories of that sort of stuff. All that developed during the Permian. All that fancy sort of stuff of being able to preserve yourself or conserve, technically conserve yourself forward to the future. Notice again, just they afforded a better food supply for the subsequently increased land animal life. Before it's needed, it's already in place. Again, because there's a truth to this whole process. Okay?
Among the land animals, the frogs reached their climax in the preceding age and rapidly declined, but they survived because they could long live even in the drying up pools and ponds of these far distant and extremely trying times. During this declining frog age in Africa, the first step in the evolution of the frog into the reptile occurred. And since the land masses were still connected, this pre-reptilian creature, an air breather, spread over all the world. By this time, the atmosphere had been so changed that it served admirably to support animal respiration. It was soon after the arrival of these pre-reptilian frogs that North America was temporarily isolated, cut off from Europe, Asia, and South America.
Yeah, and you quickly have these creatures starting to get, you know, pretty big, you know, because, you know, we're heading towards the Triassic, Jurassic, and the Cretaceous here now, you know, after this. And, you know, we're eventually going to have gigantic dinosaurs. So that moving beyond amphibians, you know, to definitive land creatures, and, you know, that's starting to happen. You know, and you've got those issues about, you know, continents being able to be quite, you know, extensively, you know, both spatially and temporally isolated, you know, starts to, you know, happen more now, so that you can get, you know, evolution of species. That's, you know, things are going on in North America and they're not going on anywhere else, you know, which wasn't so common before that, because you could pretty much in short order, you know, a given creature could get everywhere, because the land was all, you know, connected at some point or other, you know, relative to the evolutionary process. But you're starting to get, you know, a separation of that. You know, eventually you can have stuff in Australia that's, you know, been off in its own little niche, you know, for ages, separated from everything else. That sort of, you know, phenomenon is starting to occur. Okay. Let's see.
I always had a bias because reptiles are cold-blooded, that they would have been more prevalent before this climatic change.
Well, you know,
actually, it's during this.
Remember, that's one of the things that, you know, scientists are starting to appreciate more. A lot of the stuff that they've always assumed was cold-blooded wasn't, you know, that sort of stuff. All right. Okay, but, you know, extremely trying times. You know, there's a test. Right? The universe is supplying a test, and we're going to see who passes the test. It's the same thing that you're going to go through, right? Your whole existence is a test that you have to pass to get to the next stage in an ever-upward process.
Right? The gradual cooling of the ocean waters contributed much to the destruction of oceanic life. The marine animals of those ages took temporary refuge in three favorable retreats: the present Gulf of Mexico region, the Ganges Bay of India, and the Sicilian Bay of the Mediterranean Basin. And it was from these three regions that the new marine species, born to adversity, later went forth to replenish the seas.
Okay. Does that not strike you as fascinating?
Yeah.
Life is born again in the three, you know, a Western, a Central, and an Eastern again. Just like the life carriers laid it out 550 million years ago. Huh. Coincidentally. Right? You take it all and you feed it through three little capillary tubes, you know, almost nothing makes it. You know, life is born again in threefold fashion. That truth is still in play. Think how fascinating. Think of all the complicated stuff that's been happening to the geography and stuff. And it's all there and it comes right out again. That's a pretty cool process of the synchronization between the physical evolution and the biologic evolution. Even with the apparent just arbitrariness of the life carriers putting it in three spots. It's all part of a system, right? There's a wisdom to the way the life carriers put it, and that wisdom is still inherent in the system, and that wisdom comes out again in very direct form through the tribulation. See it, the wholeness of the system, how inescapable it is, right? That's pretty cool. Let's see.
Those are new species. They're not the old species.
Right. I mean, and the ones that, you know, that did make it through, you know, you know, we're often quite changed, you know.
Yeah.
Well, by the tribulation.
And in form, many of them are probably very similar because, you know, they have that niche that they're filling. But they're not the same. They're not a... They're a new species. They're not a continuation of the old species.
I mean, you know that, you know, like I pointed out, I mean, you look at a fish today, and then a lot of those Devonian fish looked an awful lot like, right, the fish today. So, I mean, some things, you know, go through pretty much unscathed. But, you know, fish aren't, you know, the story anymore, right? The stuff that goes through unscathed is parallel to the line that's becoming human. The line that's eventually going to become humans is being purified by fire. Right? We're forging Agendonter steel, right, in the Permian here. Eventual Agendonter steel. Okay?
160 million years ago, the land was largely covered with vegetation adapted to support land animal life, and the atmosphere had become ideal for animal respiration. Thus ends the period of marine life curtailment and those testing times of biologic adversity which eliminated all forms of life except such as had survival value and which were therefore entitled to function as the ancestors of the more rapidly developing and highly differentiated life of the ensuing ages of planetary evolution.
Okay.
Unmistakable.
Is that fairly obvious? Right. Again, what did they just say?
Personal words.
Had survival value. Right. You know, see, except such as had survival. Nothing of survival value is ever lost. Right. Even during the Permian tribulation. Right. And remember literally what the word survive means. It means live above. Right? The whole question is, you know, when you're thinking about whether or not you have survival value, the question is, do you have an aspect of you that is already living above, has already transcended your initial estate? Right? Live above, survive. Right? See, the whole evolutionary system is moving up. Right? And that which is inherently of the above survives. And that which is inherently not passes away. Right? The sieve to sort that out is tribulation. Right? So, I mean, yes, each of us is an individual. You know, regardless of whatever, you know, especially post-Pentecost goes on to eternity. But we're talking about, what about the evolution of the collective on this planet? Humanity is a collective, right? There needs to be a sieve, and we need to be sorted, right? And that which has the evolution of this planet survival value will go on, and that which doesn't will fade away for various reasons. Those strains will cease to be part of the evolutionary pool on this planet. So it's a very, you know, the truth is rugged.
That's a highly charged word, entitled.
Yes, right, see, entitled, right? Right. You have to prove that you have a right, you know, as a genetic line to go forward. You don't just, well, of course I have a right, I am I. No, that's your personality. We're talking about your genetics, right? That doesn't ascend to the Isle of Paradise, right? Right. You know, and, you know, if you don't pass the test, you know, your genetic line will not go forward. Okay?
The ending of this period of biologic tribulation, known to your students as the Permian, also marks the end of the long Paleozoic era, which covers one quarter of the planetary history, 250 million years. Vast oceanic nursery of life on Urantia has served its purpose. during the long ages when the land was unsuited to support life, before the atmosphere contained sufficient oxygen to sustain the higher land animals, the sea mothered and nurtured the early life of the realm. Now the biologic importance of the sea progressively diminishes as the second stage of evolution begins to unfold on the land. Presented by a life carrier of Nebadon, one of the original core assigned to Urantia.
So the purpose, the personal purposive aspect of the god of evolution would be the mother. What does it say there? The sea mothered and nurtured the early life of the realm. Right, they do everything but, you know, put in the neon flashing arrows, right, to get you to recognize what's going on. And, you know, the first sentence, the vast oceanic nursery of life, you know, nursery again, on Urantia has served its purpose. Right? It's an evolutionary process, it's purposed. You know, and purposing has a temporal component to it. You know, that which no longer serves a purpose ceases to exist.
The ocean was a womb of sorts, and out of this womb came life that went forward.
Yeah, and we literally saw, you know, a born again thing there, right? And you know, a renaissance of life on the planet, forged through tribulation, right? To have the Renaissance, that had to be preceded by the Middle Ages, specifically the Dark Ages, right? And interregnum. See, so I mean, it's those sorts of things. See, I mean, you know, you can't say for certain that an interregnum in our future is not, you know, indispensably necessary.
We didn't have to have rebellion.
Well, we didn't have to have, you know, you don't have to have sin and iniquity, right? You know, especially extensively, right? But you know, we're not talking about sin and iniquity here. We're just talking about, you know, there was an interregnum in the life during the Permian period, right? But it came out better than ever before, okay? So there's lessons. We all need to take a deep breath and rise to the challenge of being in an evolutionary domain. It's a rugged process, and you need courage. You know, you don't just need independent cosmic thinking. You need courageous and independent cosmic thinking, because the tests will come, and you will fail the test without courage. They're going to be trying tests. So, it doesn't take a lot of reflection to see the poignancy of the truth that's flowing through Permian times and how that's utterly relevant here and now, not just there and then. It's the truths of eternity. They apply everywhere for all time. Yeah.
I've always been of the opinion that there wouldn't be an interregnum, that we would skate through.
Again, you can argue it both ways. We can all have our opinions, our speculations, but you know, if there's an interregnum, that will be a divine dispensation. Exactly. Right? And if there isn't, that will also be a divine dispensation. See, again, we're saying, well, no, obviously, if there's an interregnum, you know, I will have prickly feelings during that, so that would be bad. Right? Again, you don't define, right, the goodness or badness of an interregnum about, you know, how prickly it is for you. Right? It's not, you know, especially when you don't, when you remember that goodness out here in an evolutionary domain is perfectingness. Not perfectness. I mean, sure, an interregnum is not perfectness, but neither is the non-interregnum that might come next. That won't be perfectness either. But both will be perfecting this. Look at the perfecting this that was in the, you know, the extinction of over 99.5% of all the species.
Climate change. That's what it was.
Right. And so you're going, huh, you don't suppose there's supposed to be climate change coming. And that maybe there's nothing we can do to stop it.
There isn't.
That's
a silly thing.
Right? Okay, anyway, we don't want to go on, but you get the point, right? I mean, I shouldn't have to paint these pictures for you. This should be pretty self-evident what this is trying to teach us and how we just aren't obeying these truths right now. Right? We have these bizarre, tangential, delusional, false worldviews that we're trying to live. Right? And it's so much so that I have a fifth epical revelation in my lap, right? That's how much we're not living the truth. Not obeying the truth. Why do you languish in futile yearning? Because you obey not the truth. Yeah. And that's being generous. It might be, why do you rage as a heathen? Because you know not the truth. All right, we got lots of heathen raging right now, right, that know not the truth.
Yeah,
right?
But they're focused.
But they're children of God, and they'll get to the first mansion world, all that. It's not an individual salvation issue, right? It's a civilizational issue.
No, but I mean, he went on to say, but they're focused. And they,
right.
Take
it. Right. Yeah, why don't you take it like the heathen, like the heathen take a city? Yes, exactly. Right. Okay. All right, so that so we'll move to the land life next time, as you can see here. Let's take a moment here, everyone.